I'm excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show. It will be a step into the uncommon, and I'm very, very excited. So for any of you who remember watching the magnificent television series Downton Abbey, of course, one of the stars of that program, aside from all of the marvelous actors who brought those characters so thrillingly to life, one of the actors or characters, in a sense, was that magnificent castle where most of the filming of Downton Abbey occurred. That would be the Highclere Castle. And I am very, very pleased today to be speaking with Lady Carnarvon, who is one of the current owners and residents of Highclere Castle. And she is also joined by a young American entrepreneur by the name of Adam von Gutkin. And Adam is the co-founder and CEO of Highclere Castle Cigar. And so this is a company which is releasing a premium cigar that is conceived as the sort of cigar that might very well have been smoked in a place like magnificent Highclere Castle at the height of its glory. And so we're going to be talking with both of these people about this venture and about beautiful Highclere Castle, which has inspired it. Lady Carnarvon and Adam von Gutkin, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you for having us.
So happy to have you here. So, first of all, Lady Carnarvon, I would love to find out a little bit about your own relationship, that is, you and your husband, to Highclere Castle, which is now your home. At what point did this amazing castle become your home, and under what circumstances?
Well, it became part of my husband's family home in 1679, so it's a little time ago now. And my husband lived here all his life, actually, and when his father died in 2001, it then fell to us to run it during our lifetime. So we've been, I suppose we've got our sort of knees under the table, if you like, to try to work out how to make the house resonate and how to make people fall in love with it in today's world. So we've been taking those first steps for the last 14 or 15 years and now have decided to kind of use the brand and the beautiful ambiance that Highclere has to step into the world of cigars.
Hmm.
What fun.
Yes, absolutely. And I look forward to exploring that in just a moment. Could you say a word about the opportunity to put Highclere Castle front and center with this amazing television series? I'm curious about, in a sense, what kind of overture was made to you and your husband, and how you greeted the notion of television cameras tracking into your grounds and into the heart of the home. Did you immediately and easily welcome that opportunity, or was that something you had to think long and hard about?
Well, I think it's always better to think about something before you do it, because we've done various films before, you know, from the Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and there was a Jeeves and Wooster, which is a big UK series, and parts of other TV and films have been shot here. So we were, you know, we had taken part in the film world, but not to this extent. And when George and I took over Highclere, my husband and I then began to bring the castle back and be able to stay and renovate the bedrooms and ask friends to come and stay. And one of those friends was Julian Emma Fellows. So they would come for a weekend. So it's all about weekends, really. And good food and good wine. And the idea of Downton Abbey was conceived. So Julian actually wrote Downton Abbey for Highclere, which he has said a few times. And then a bit later, the location scouts came round. We began to talk about, you know, being the location for this extraordinary series. So good wine, good food, and I suppose the odd cigar. And actually, that's what Downton Abbey was about. Lots of scenes in the dining room and lots of very good food.
Hmm. One thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of that magnificent structure, I have seen it described as a country house, which I suppose in at least some sense of that of the word is exactly what it is. Although, of course, just to take a glance at it, that is, it is nothing like what, for instance, the typical American would think of as a country home. And also that it is apparently in the Jacobean style. I wonder if you could say a word first about that matter of it being a country house and in this particular style. Is there anything you can tell us about that?
Well, you're right, Greg. Well, it's a house in the country, but it's a little bit big, isn't it? There's 200 or 300 rooms and there's 50 to 80 bedrooms, so it's on the large size. But, you know, there's been a building at Highclere where the current castle stands for 1,300 years. So my earliest records are 749 AD. And they've just changed the building and built different structures, buildings, churches around that same sort of space. And then in 1842, Sir Charles Barry, who was also commissioned to rebuild the Houses of Parliament in London, began to build Highclere Castle on top of an earlier Georgian house. So he took it up and made it larger. And it's described variously as Gothic. The Victorians were quite keen on the Gothic period or Jacobean or whatever people wish to do. We sort of describe it as Italianate, with pinnacles and spires soaring towards the skies. But I don't mind. We can have a competition. Who can best describe it?
One of the things that intrigued me most when I read up a little bit on the history of the house, the more recent history of the house, is how the castle was used during the Second World War as a home for some of the children who had been evacuated, I would presume maybe evacuated out of London. That must give you great pride to know that.
It does. Well, actually, in the First World War, it was really a hospital, and it was there for a place of healing. So Highclere's had a few good roles before Downton, and as a hospital and a place of healing, that was a very good one in the First World War. And we're actually going to recreate the hospital and commemorate the end of the First World War in this September to try to raise money for soldiers and doctors in today's war zones, including, I hope, some American vets. And I hope I'll have some American soldiers here as well. So that's the first incarnation. And the second one, in the Second World War, was, you're quite right, the evacuee children from London, aged between 3 and 5 years old, so just tiny, were brought out here by coach, and they lived in the top floor of the castle with their teachers and nurses during the Second World War. Some of them actually were so homesick, their parents came and collected them, and their parents so missed them, they went back to London, and obviously later on London then had to survive the Blitz. So I wrote about it in a book called Lady Catherine and the Real Downton Abbey, which has been very well received in America. So I've been most lucky, Greg, and it is a great story. General Patton was here. So we have had some amazing Americans also pass through and have lunch at Highclere during that Second World War period.
Hmm. I know that there was a period before, in a sense, you and your husband took over the castle, that it fell into some disrepair. Not a surprise for a structure that had stood there for so long. And if I understand correctly, there was a period of time where it was not really lived in the sense that it is lived in now, or had been lived in its more distant past. Can you tell us sort of whatever you care to tell us about, in a sense, the renaissance of the structure itself, the kind of work that has needed to be done to bring it up to its current state of splendor?
You're quite right. My parents-in-law did not live in the castle when they inherited it from my grandfather-in-law. They lived in another house. They were slightly older, and it is rather large and quite a lot of work. They did a lot of renovation in the period that they had it, particularly some of the major rooms downstairs. And I suppose I've just picked the baton up after that, and it's just picking up the baton and trying to pass it on to the next generation. In the meantime, planting trees, doing your best. and engaging with people to try to give it a life in today's world. But we have, I've done a huge, I'm quite good at plumbers, electricians. You know, my little black book is full of Steve the roofer and Dave the electrician, Jeff and Mark the plumbers, Pat the decorator. So that is a big part of my world. And then on top of that, we've got cottages, some of which I rent out, and I've got a few short-term ones, which are particularly appreciated by travellers from abroad. We've got a huge medieval barn, which is phenomenal. And before I came on the phone, I was just reading about the repairs to it in the 14th century. So I've got a list of repairs which were never ending, you know, in 1318, 1390, 1393. So, which kind of fills me with reassurance that this is the way of things such as it is. And that's another big project we're working on. So they are never ending, really. And the thing to do is just to keep going and take one step after another. And I think today, for me, what matters most about the house is the community. It's the people coming here. It is those the eating together, dining together. It is a good bottle of wine. That is what perhaps matters to me most in life and living in the now.
That will be a nice segue to talking about cigars, which we'll get to in just a moment. I just wanted to ask you, what kind of a structure is it in which to live? I believe you and your husband live there for a significant portion of the year, if not quite year-round. I'm just curious, a structure like this with literally hundreds of rooms, what is it like to live in such a place?
Well, I will now stay there without anybody else, although to start with, I didn't, because it is quite a big house and it has its own sort of noises and feelings, if you like, as it settles down for the night. It's an extraordinary place to wake up to in the morning when you open the shutters. There's a couple of very important points, particularly for Americans. There is not a single shower in the entire castle. There is one small television, no Wi-Fi. There are a couple of phones, which if you run for, you normally miss. And there's obviously not a lot of central heating, so none of the bedrooms have any central heating. There is some around the castle itself. So it's back to, I suppose, in some ways, where I was brought up, which is if you were cold in bed, you wore a pair of socks or put a jumper on. So I think I'm back to my childhood again at this time of year.
Wonderful. Is it a place that people can stay, or is it more in terms of access to the public, or is it more that it is something of a museum which people visit but then depart from?
It's definitely not a museum. Many people come for tours. You can't stay here. And it's for tours. Some people have lunches or afternoon teas. And we create different events, which I hope people might enjoy. Sometimes it's all about cooking. Sometimes it's about the gardens. I'm doing a week about script to screen, which is thinking about how you take words on a page. It is the most magnificent library. And that made me think about, let's look at how you start with those words and turn them into engaging characters, which, you know, we all enjoy on television, TV, or film. So I sort of mix around what I put out there in case people would like to come, which at the moment it seems to be working, and we have a lot of people coming, and I want them to enjoy themselves. So that's my thought. How can I create things which people will enjoy?
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking on the morning show with Lady Carnarvon. She and Lord Lady Carnarvon are the current owners and primary occupants of Highclere Castle, which is one of the most magnificent of structures in all of England, and the site of the primary photography or filming of Downton Abbey. So all of those exterior shots of that stunning castle where those characters lived and worked are this Highclere Castle.
It's the interiors as well. I mean, they were here for 6 months, so they would turn up in February. It was the rooms, the bedrooms, passageways, gardens. And they used to sometimes pretend Highclere was somewhere else, but much of it was filmed at Highclere. They arrived in February, and they left in early July.
I am so glad to know that. My understanding was that it was that that it was mostly the outside of the building and some of the grounds and so on. I'm so glad to know that also the interiors, at least to a large extent, were used.
It's my dining room you're looking at. It's my library. I've read all the books, of course. No, but it is. It is actually, yeah, I think it forms the heart. It captures the characters together. They use our staff stairs. They, as I said, you know, there was the Grantham's bedroom or Sybil's bedroom or the famous red bedroom from the first series when the Turk died, which also then doubled as a bedroom for Shirley MacLaine later on and then for someone else. So some of them got reused over. But yes, a lot of it was shot here, the fields or the farm, the hunt scenes. Because we've got a lot of car parking, it was very convenient for them. So, and we're near London, which is also very convenient for many of the actors.
Wow. And they were good and gracious and grateful guests, I am guessing.
Greg, they were a film company.
Enough said. Well, let's get to the matter of the Highclere Castle cigar. And Adam von Guttgen was, as the co-founder and CEO, I am assuming that this was an amazing and maybe even audacious idea of your own. Tell us more about the genesis of all this.
You know, it started really a couple of years ago, with my background being primarily in spirits. I reached out to Lord and Lady Carnarvon with an idea. You know, we were literally watching Downton Abbey, and my partners and I here back in the U.S. had been looking to expand our own portfolio of very authentic, special products that spoke to kind of a magic and authenticity. And so I sent an email out just inquiring as to who I might speak to have a conversation around the idea of doing a Highclere Castle spirit, primarily gin and whiskey. And so that really started what became kind of a two-year journey for us. And while that was happening and while that's been in the works, a very good friend of mine, whose name is Nick Melillo, is a world-renowned cigar blender. And his company is called Foundation Cigar. He's got many, you know, many very famous, successful cigars that people appreciate. You know, they come from fields in Nicaragua, the factories in Nicaragua. A lot of very intense passion around tobacco and fine cigars. And so, you know, I thought that cigars and spirits obviously go hand in hand. And with Highclere's very long legacy of enjoying cigars in the library after dinner with a good spirit, that this might be something that we should look at as well. And so, so Nick really helped to bring that to life with his skill and craftsmanship. And we launched last July, and it started shipping around the United States this last fall and winter to absolutely amazing reviews and accolades. So we're very proud of it.
So what would be some of the most telling details? And I suspect these will probably mean the most to somebody who's a real cigar aficionado. But even for the layperson listening in who has never smoked a cigar and knows very little about them, what kinds of things were thought about in terms of the details to make this a cigar that was, in a sense, reminiscent of what might have been enjoyed in a place like Highclere Castle or in some way reflective of its history?
Yeah, Greg, so it's interesting. We had this crazy idea in our head that we wanted to produce a cigar in the flavor profile and aroma style of the type of cigars being imported directly to Highclere Castle around the turn of the century. And so we got access to the archives of Highclere, and we were able to find actual receipts, import receipts, from the 5th and 6th Earl Carnarvon's time period. And Nick, being completely obsessed with all things tobacco, was able to look at the type of cigar from that time period, where it was coming in from, and ascertain what the flavor profiles would have been like for that style of tobacco and cigar, which is actually quite a bit different from the mainstream cigars that are smoked today. They were much more, they were much smoother back then. They were a little bit more delicate. They were really kind of designed to be a gentleman's cigar. And so we wanted to capture that essence. We wanted to, you know, kind of imbibe the cigar with flavors that when I went to High Clere to visit, I was struck with. For example, I absolutely love the smell of the High Clere Castle Library. When you walk in, you smell 400 years, 500 years of leather books. And you smell that smell of kind of yesterday's fireplace. And I really wanted to have those flavors kind of integrated so that if you're smoking the cigar, you could close your eyes and you could almost be at High Clere 100 years ago, or sitting with Winston Churchill, who was a visitor, or some of the other kind of amazing people that have spent time at High Clere. And so we captured that. And we did that by Nick doing his research, and then by integrating actual tobaccos from Nicaragua, including Corojo, Criollo, which are from Ometepe, a volcanic island in Nicaragua, and from Jalapa, the jungle. We used a Mata Fina binder, which is from Cruz de las Almas in Brazil, a very dark and robust binder for the cigar. And then we wrapped it in a Connecticut Shade, a very delicate wrapper. It's also very pretty and was very, very popular at the turn of the century. And so in composition itself, the blend that Nick Melillo did, combined with the research that we did and the vision we had, all came together for this magnificent cigar.
Ah, and you sound like you are very pleased with how it has thus been received and reviewed.
Yeah, and I'm a little bit biased, of course. So what matters more to me is that, you know, when I've been to these events or we've done these cigar dinners, or even just a couple weeks ago, I was at High Clere for a weekend, and there was, you know, friends and family were visiting of Lord and Lady Carnarvon's, and to see the smiles on their faces as they stepped out to the terrace, you know, after dinner and lit one of these cigars up as the fog is kind of hanging around High Clere's hills, and we're out there in the back having a gin and a whiskey and smoking a cigar, and it just, nothing pleases me more than seeing people take time to relax, enjoy good company, and just kind of savor handmade quality things that people really care about.
If people want more information about the cigar, the High Clere Castle cigar, where do you want to direct them?
The website is highclerecastlecigar.com. And, of course, on Instagram and social media, it's High Clere Castle Cigar.
Very good. I wanted to mention before we go that High Clere Castle itself has a magnificent website, which is highclerecastle.co.uk. And Lady Carnarvon, I want to say that you have a most impressive blog that I have explored and will continue to explore. Right now I am reading a post from back in November called Food, Glorious Food, in which you talk about the pleasure of cooking with Mary Berry, that many Americans will know from the great British baking show. But you write about many other aspects as well of living at High Clere Castle. I want to compliment you on a really beautiful website. I can tell that it gives you great pleasure to share the good word about High Clere Castle in this way.
Thank you. It is a fun thing to do, and I've done the videos as well as the blogs now, and it's a great community spirit that comes through, actually, and it has. Thank you very much, Craig. That's very kind of you. So I post every Monday, and I'm becoming religious about so doing, and it's quite fun thinking of the next one. Some of them are quite silly, but I am the archivist, so I love finding the stories. So I've been researching on some of the cigars, and, you know, I think the box that the cigars are in as well is very beautiful. So I hope we'll find ever more stories and people will enjoy this particular enterprise of ours throughout the U.S.
Very good. Lady Carnarvon, she and her husband, Lord Carnarvon, the current owners and primary occupants of beautiful High Clere Castle, and Adam von Gutkin, the co-founder and CEO of High Clere Castle Cigar. I thank both of you so much for being part of the morning show today. It was such a pleasure and privilege to speak with you. Best wishes.
Thank you
so much, Greg. Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD. The time is approaching 8:35. Part 2 coming up in a moment. Thank you. For part two of today's program, we're going to be looking back 50 years to the tragic My Lai massacre in Vietnam by replaying a portion of my conversation with Beric Goodman, writer, producer, and director of a marvelous American experience documentary called My Lai, which is now streaming on the PBS website, pbs.org.
This film came to me from my executive producer, Mark Sammels, who called me one day and suggested this subject. I was looking for a film, and it took me all of about 10 seconds to agree to do it. I had, of course, heard of the My Lai massacre, but didn't know much about it, but had always been intrigued by the idea of unpacking a single kind of war story like this and trying to understand it. And it proved to be just as complex and interesting as I'd hoped.
Going into this, you obviously are old enough to have some recollection of it. This is an event which occurred back in 1968. But really, what was the extent of your knowledge about My Lai before you undertook this project?
Well, I was a kid. I was 5 years old when this happened, and didn't have firsthand memory. But like a lot of people, kind of heard of Lieutenant Calley, the sort of main protagonist in the story, if you want to call him that, and was intrigued by the notion of digging into the Vietnam War, which, as you said in your introduction, continues to be a source of anguish and kind of, you know, controversy even to this day. And I was especially intrigued by the idea of doing a story which is so timely. I mean, here we are again in foreign wars in countries we don't really understand, sending our very young men into these very kind of confusing and complex situations. And I thought that the massacre and understanding why and how these soldiers perpetrated this deed would shed a lot of light on what our current situation is. So those were all the sorts of positive motivations for going into such a dark hole as I knew I was going into.
I should think that one challenge, and it would be a challenge on a couple of different levels, was making connections with the people who ultimately are part of this film, including some soldiers speaking publicly about My Lai for the very first time, and others who have studied it and so on. From a logistical point of view, the challenge of connecting with important players. But then on top of it, I should think a very sort of emotional, personal kind of challenge as well, in terms of exactly how one approaches, for instance, a soldier who has this in their own past, in their own personal history. Talk first of all about the more mundane of those two challenges, the logistics of connecting, and then we need to talk about the way in which you ultimately sat down with some of these players and evoked their stories from them.
Well, there were about 120 members of Charlie Company. Charlie Company is the unit that perpetrated the My Lai massacre, and they are, of course, scattered to the winds now. And it was a somewhat painstaking process to find them. The internet makes that kind of searching for people far easier than it used to be. But the names of these soldiers were readily available. The government had done a full investigation of My Lai in the early 1970s and had done extensive interviews, which were transcribed and published. So we knew, generally speaking, who the players were and what each of them had done, more or less. And from there, it was a matter of finding through the internet where those men currently are, matching names with ages, with anecdotes that we had heard about where they were from originally, where they might have returned. It's astonishing to me how many people return back to where they were born or where they grew up. And then once we had found a few, some of these soldiers were in touch with each other, so they, you know, turned us on to others. And pretty soon we had at least made contact with, I would say, about 30 of the most important players in the story. At that point, as you rightly point out, the challenge is how to approach them, with what you know, leverage one can bring on these guys, because this is not a subject that people are wanting to return to very readily. And that was just a long and kind of, you know, gentle process of winning trust and making them understand that really, and this was sincere all the way to my heart, that this was going to be a film that looked at the story from their point of view. We wanted to embed ourselves inside Charlie Company. We wanted to understand how this happened. For 40 years, these guys have felt judged, condemned, misunderstood, and many of them, I think, wanted to talk, but only if they felt sincerely that the producer of the film was really listening to them. And fortunately, I didn't have to put that on. It was really what we wanted to do. We wanted to hear their side of the story. So once we got a few of them, kind of word spread a little bit, and then there was a sort of moment where there was a rush of people wanting to participate in the film, and that was that was wonderful.
One of the questions I have is whether or not we, as you approached these gentlemen, were there certain things you said or certain ways in which you couched the invitation to convey the very reassurance that you just said was so necessary for them to feel like they could be part of this wholeheartedly?
I don't think there was any magic bullet. It was a courtship. It often took a couple of personal visits. I think always in these kinds of situations, knowing a great deal about your subject helps. They feel reassured if you know in great depth the story. And we had the benefit of these original investigations. We had a very, very detailed understanding of almost kind of minute by minute what happened. And the other thing is that we spent a lot of time talking about the build-up to My Lai, the weeks and months before My Lai, which I don't think you can tell this story without truly understanding what these men went through in Vietnam. And I think it's really the most important part of the story. And they all felt that way. And I think that once they understood that was the sort of heart of the film, the part of the film that was new and different and from what had gone before, that's when I think they began to see that this was something they could be a part of. They wanted to tell that part of the story. They wanted to say, look, we didn't just drop into My Lai and go crazy. There was a whole, you know, complex set of reasons and factors and a confluence of circumstances that led to this. And they wanted to get that story out for the most part. Of course, there were many who chose not to appear, and I was disappointed about that. There were some key people who just wouldn't go public, including Lieutenant Calley himself. But for the most part, I would say 75% of the people we met ultimately agreed to be in the film.
By the way, did you make a concerted effort to connect with Lieutenant William Calley?
We did. We made a very concerted effort. There was an initial effort that met with no success. But then towards the end of the film, all of a sudden, Lieutenant Calley broke a 40-year silence and appeared at a public gathering in Georgia and made a public statement of remorse, the first time he'd spoken publicly, as I said, in 40 years. At that point, of course, we resumed our efforts and again sent him a couple of letters, which we know he received, you know, saying that maybe things had changed and would he consider it. And I think he's just not going to speak to the media. I think he views the media as the enemy, and no amount of kind of reassurance or appeal will overcome that resistance. So he refused again.
As you talked about your encounters with these soldiers and their appreciation that the story was told in more fuller fashion, oddly enough, I'm reminded of an interview I saw maybe a year ago with figure skater Tanya Harding, in which she was asked a number of questions about landing her first triple axel, the first American figure skater to do so. And as they were playing a clip and she was sort of talking about that amazing moment when she stuck the landing and, you know, had made history. And, you know, she has this wonderful grin on her face and then dissolves into tears and then apologizes and says, I'm sorry, nobody ever asks me about this anymore.
Right.
And, of course, it's because the story of Tonya Harding is poisoned by what occurred thereafter. And in a sense, in a rough parallel, I admit, but it seems to me that this opportunity afforded to these soldiers involved in one way or another with My Lai was, in a sense, a similar sort of opportunity for them, and one I suspect they deeply appreciated.
Yeah, I think that they, you know, they certainly don't want to, they certainly don't consider themselves heroes, but they also don't consider themselves anomalies. These were ordinary guys, and we start the film with a sort of profile of several of them. They were just regular old, yet very young men, typical Vietnam conscripts, and their experience was very typical. There was nothing atypical, really, about what took place for Charlie Company. They were in a particularly violent area of Vietnam, but so were many others. And I think the underlying message of the film is that while there may not have been many My Lais, there were probably some version of My Lai happened elsewhere in Vietnam. It could have happened at any moment to almost any unit in Vietnam. Such were the circumstances, such was the strategy we were pursuing, such was the messages that the command structure was sending down to ordinary soldiers, that ordinary civilian lives are not really to be valued. And I think that's really the core message of the film, that these guys happened to be in the place and time, and there happened to be a set of conditions that led to this, but it could have really happened to almost any unit in Vietnam, and probably many units in Afghanistan as well. So that's the real message that they wanted to get out, that, hey, you know, we've been walking around with this scarlet letter on our chest for 40 years, but, you know, look at us. We're no different from any other Vietnam veterans.
A last question about that, and then we'll dig into the specifics of the story. One of the things I took away from the film, and we've really been kind of talking about this all along now, is how fair this film is, how honest it is, how frank it is, graphic at certain points. I mean, it is not that anything is being soft-pedaled. In no way is anyone being excused for things they did. And yet somehow I feel like what you have managed to accomplish here is a tremendously fair film. As you put this film together, I suspect that was a very important principle. Can you just talk a moment about the ways in which you kept that in mind and maybe pondered how to be thorough and fair in telling this complex and ultimately horrific story?
I think what you're really seeing is my own lack of certainty about the story. I didn't really know how to feel about it. The more I got into it, the more I came to know these men, I didn't have a clear sense of outrage or sort of judgment. I kept asking myself, as anybody I think watching the film will, what would you have done in that circumstance? Would you have had the strength to resist an order? Would you have automatically said to yourself, you know, this is wrong, and or would you have been like most of them, you know, overwhelmed by the circumstances, by the experiences you were having, alone, you know, scared? Would you have lost your moral bearings just like they did? There's a wonderful moment in the film where one of the more intelligent and kind of thoughtful soldiers asks himself that question, and he can't answer it. He was one of the few who didn't participate in the massacre itself, but he wonders if he'd been directly ordered to do the killing, would he have been able to stop himself? It's not an easy question. It is a gray area, and I genuinely felt unsure. And we've in some of the screenings we've been having, public screenings, we've had wonderful debates in the audience afterwards between members of the audience about, you know, is it possible to resist an order in combat? Is it is is it? Are there limits in war? Can you really create bright lines which say you shall go this far but no further? Or is war itself essentially such a kind of crazy endeavor that there really are no, there can be no rules of morality? All these things are at play in this story, which is why I love doing it so much and why I think it's an important film. It's because these are very tough questions to answer, but we continue to find ourselves in these kinds of wars and up against these questions.
Right. And towards that very question of, is it ever, are there certain absolute rights and wrongs and moral imperatives that in a sense usurp an order given by your superior officer? We hear conflicting opinion in your film on that very question. And I appreciate that so much, because that is in contrast to other films that are really only about putting forward a single opinion, a single perspective on an important question like this. You embrace the ambiguity, the uncertainty that surrounds a question like that.
We have a character in the film who I regard as kind of the moral center of the film. He is the prosecutor in the Callie case. When Lieutenant Callie was brought to trial, he prosecuted him, and he's never spoken before, and he's widely considered the most effective and persuasive prosecutor in the entire My Lai incident. And it's been his point of view all along, and it's very moving when he talks about it, that there have to be rules and limits in war, that we can't forget who we are and what we're fighting for, or we become animals. We become just like the enemy that we're supposed to be fighting. And it's a very persuasive argument. But when that argument is put to the soldiers themselves, they scoff at it. They say that, you know, when you're given an order in war, if we are trained to follow it, and if we don't follow it, we're subject to, you know, even to be shot. And so to assume that we are going to be able to, as 19-year-old, you know, raw recruits, being able to disobey an order because our conscience tells us to is just unrealistic. And I had a hard time reconciling those two points of view. I had a hard time saying, yeah, I agree with that one over that one. And so really there was no choice but to entertain both of them in the film and to let people line up where they would.
You're listening to a portion of a conversation I had with writer and producer Beric Goodman about the American Experience documentary, My Lai. We have just passed the 50th anniversary of this tragedy in which a number of civilians in the village of My Lai were massacred by U.S. soldiers. Evidently, what led in part to this massacre was the dissemination of incorrect intelligence, which led the soldiers of Charlie Company to believe that enemy operatives of the Viet Cong were in this village of My Lai and that no civilians, in fact, were there. I asked Beric Goodman if we understand to this day just how this intelligence snafu occurred.
There's a little bit of ambiguity still to this day about why the intelligence was so wrong. The intelligence, as I said, had a Viet Cong regiment in this village, but the regiment was actually 150 miles away across the province on the other side. Why they got that so wrong is subject to a lot of debate. One of the main theories that's been put forward is that we misunderstood the nomenclature of the villages. The word My Lai is an American construct. It's not what the villagers themselves call that particular area in Vietnam. And we may just have confused some intelligence about where My Lai actually was. That's sort of the main theory, but it's still somewhat unclear as to why the command structure believed that this regiment could be located in this village. Someone recently I was talking to, a very well-regarded and, you know, well-informed journalist, said it was absolutely absurd to think that there was going to be a regiment sitting in this village. It's just not the way the Viet Cong operated. They never came down and sort of, you know, occupied a village and made themselves sitting ducks for superior U.S. Military force. They always hid in the jungle. So it was a fantasy, again, of a kind of war that we were not waging, but that we kind of hoped we could wage.
it was, in a sense, wishful thinking
carried
out to a tragic extent.
Yes, and the order that the briefing that was given on March 15th, the day before the massacre, was tragic in so many ways. It was, I don't think that Captain Medina, who was the captain of Charlie Company who gave the briefing, intended for the company to kill civilians. But he did intend to give a Newt Rockne kind of speech to get them riled up, and he used words and phrases and conveyed an impression, I think, that was unfortunate, that, you know, that there wouldn't be no civilians, that anybody you saw in this village was the enemy, that there really were, you couldn't really go in there with anything but a desire to kill everything. And that left the soldiers in this peculiar situation where if they were going to stop themselves, they were going to have to feel like they were countermanding an order to do so. And that made it much harder for them to stop.
I suspect that it was an incredibly powerful challenge for you to tell the story of what comes next. That is to put on the screen images and words essentially telling the story of the massacre itself. And we leave that, of course, to our listeners to experience for themselves. But I wonder if you could just speak a moment from the perspective of a filmmaker to just talk about maybe some of what you thought about and weighed in deciding what exactly to put on the screen to help us, from the safety of our living room seats, in a sense, be there in My Lai at this awful moment?
Well, it's a really good question, and we did wrestle with it a lot. There was so much that went on that day. It was a disorganized, chaotic event in which no one person knew the entirety of what was happening. And the fog of war was very much in place. So we decided that we wouldn't have anybody describing anything that they didn't themselves participate in. In other words, nobody could say someone else did something. I saw such and such a person do that, or I heard about such and such a person do that. And that, of course, eliminated right away a lot of the most gruesome and horrific stuff, because most of the soldiers weren't willing to discuss their own participation in that. Now, that still left for us, you know, eyewitness accounts of absolute horror. There's nobody that could watch this film and not feel like we were sugarcoating what happened at My Lai. But we did want it to be firsthand eyewitness or, you know, descriptions of their own actions. So the massacre, and the other thing that's important is that we wanted the Vietnamese voices. We were fortunate to be able to find survivors from the village who, most of whom had not spoken publicly before, but who were, again, kind of carrying this around and wanting to testify to what happened. And so we kind of intercut the stories of the soldiers and the stories of the survivors, often to the point where they're describing this exact same event from opposite points of view.
Hmm. Barrett Goodman, director and writer and producer of the American Experience documentary, My Lai, which is now streaming on the PBS website, pbs.org.